Mystifying Real 8. Now, you left Bermuda, I think, on the 8th of September 1943 and went to Norfolk, Virginia to pick up the Victorious. Could you tell us about that? What happened there?
We went to pick up the Victorious. It was a big fleet carrier. We headed north. And on this subject, my mind is a little bit hazy. I know we had two other escorts with us. They were fleet class destroyers, the Optune and the Obdurate. They took station on port and starboard side of the carrier. And we were bringing up in the rear. I don't know if anybody who speaks hears this, has ever been in a comparatively small ship, no more than 1,300 tons, and going along in the wake of an approximately 40,000 ton ship. But I can assure you it is not a pleasant experience. We went north to our gents here in Newfoundland. And I cannot remember after that whether we brought a convoy back to the UK, whether we brought the Victorious back, or we came back on our own. I am inclined to think from a picture I had, which is taken in mid-Atlantic, from what we can only assume is an American Coast Guard plane, because this comes from the American archives, this picture, and we are very much on our own. I just cannot remember the details. We arrived back in Belfast. A lot of work was done on the ship.
Now, what do you remember? That was the refitting. What do you remember the refitting? It was at Pollock Dock.
Pollock Dock, yes.
What changes did they make that you were aware of?
Well, the whole messing arrangements were changed. That is about the only thing I can really remember. The messing arrangements were changed in so much as that each mess deck had two men appointed to cook of the day for 24 hours, and at meal times, the two cooks went to the galley and collected the appropriate food for their mess deck. After breakfast in the mornings, the two of you scrubbed out the mess deck, making sure everything was reasonably clean. Went and got midday meal and the evening meal and did the washing up.
That's it. What about the removal of some of the luxury American items?
Now you mention it, yes. The water fountain was removed. I can't remember. It just gone. I remember the water fountain being removed.
Did you mind that? I mean, why did they remove it?
I've no idea. I think it was against the Royal Navy principles. We had it for a while on board, but I suppose being Brits, we were so uneducated in the style of life of having constant cold water available, which is something the Americans have always had. And I don't suppose you really missed it. It's too long ago.
Now, you were attached to the 4th...
We became attached to the 4th Escort Group, which consisted of the Bentinck, the Bayard, the Drury, the Paisley.
And
ourselves, Corbin. I think Blackwood was with us for a little while. In total, over the period of our the fourth life, there was 8 ships that came under the heading of the 4th Escort Group, but at any one time there was only 6 operational.
Now, you were a turbo electric, so a couple of these, well, Baisley, Blackwood and Drury, they were diesel electric. Yes. What differences did you notice?
Well, we didn't notice anything because the main difference was the other 3 were slightly slower at top speed than us, but I can't ever remember working the 6 of us that we ever went at top speed. The only time I can ever remember, and I can't remember the reason why, I think the war was over. We finished up in Londonderry and we were coming round to Belfast, and I think we opened up to our full capacity, and the vibration, the shaking was quite something.
So you weren't particularly aware of the difference between the
No, the actual visible difference that you didn't really notice was that they were slightly shorter than us and they had a curved funnel as opposed to our square funnel.
Now, your first thing was you were sent on a convoy escort into the Bay of Biscay in November 1943. Yeah. And quite a lot happened because this was one of the last battles for the Wolf Pack. What do you remember of that?
There is one instance I remember, although not in great detail. It was during the middle watch. It was somewhere around about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was on watch on the radar set, not on the plot, but actually on the set. And I picked up an echo on the port side. I cannot remember now how far away it was, but somewhere from memory between 6,000 and 8,000 yards. From my experience by then of utilising a radar set, I realised it was a low-lying echo in the water, and it was assumed that it was a U-boat. We turned towards it, and obviously I was repeating the range and bearing as we approached it, and as far as I could see, we were coming up astern of the U-boat, because obviously on the surface we assumed charging its batteries. And I think at about 2,000 yards we fired a star shell. Now I only subsequently found out afterwards the reason for this star shell was it was an Admiralty instruction that as there was a convoy in the near vicinity, a star shell was there to drive the U-boat underneath, down. Obviously, I'm not an expert, far from it, but I feel if we hadn't given away our presence, we'd have got much closer to the U-boat than we did, but this is purely personal. We attacked his depth charges.
It dived when
it dived, yeah. Disappeared very quickly. Obviously, I lost the echo on the screen very quickly. And we dropped, I don't remember how many sets of depth charges, but we did drop quite a lot. And after a while, there was a massive explosion heard beneath the water, but no debris came to the surface. it could therefore never be completely substantiated that we actually got this U-boat.
So what else do you remember about this? You were defending a couple of convoys.
Convoys running around like scalding cats from one place to another.
What was the routine like for you on your action stations?
Well, naval routine at sea was by and large a very boring situation. You spent 95% of your life and time rehearsing, practicing, doing your watchkeeping, and only about 5% of the time using all your knowledge. I suppose the same as all other forces, you're trained for a short period to produce what you know in a short space of time.
So what was a typical watch like for you?
A typical watch?
On action stations.
Ah, now.
On the radar, sir.
Now, bear with me. You have two different things. A watch is a normal watch. Action station, closed up.
Okay, watch duty first.
A watch. There was three watches a day. The watches were the first watch, which was 8 in the evening to midnight. The middle watch was midnight to 4 in the morning. The morning watch was 4 in the morning to 8. The forenoon watch was 8 until 12. The afternoon watch was 12 until 4. And the first dog watch was 4 to 6. And the second dog, the last dog, 6 to 8. That gave you the changeover. The worst watch of the lot, in my opinion, was the morning watch.
And what would you be doing during a normal watch system?
There was two of you on watch in the radar office, connected with the radar. One of you spent a half an hour on the set, obviously in touch with the bridge at all times, reporting or getting instructions through a voice pipe. The other half hour, you were off the set and gave your eyes a rest. You were logging any reports that the operator was giving or receiving. Instructions, and also there was the plot table there, which I mentioned before, was geared to doing plotting for the ASDIC, which was a voice track straight with the ASDIC, and the person who wasn't on watch on the radar set was also able to use the plot table. Action stations were very much the same. You did your half hour about, unless for some particular reason, which I can't remember at the moment, you stayed on the set. But it was very much the same, because the strain on the eyes was quite excessive. You were in darkness looking at lights. And I suppose it did make sense.
What could you see on the screen? I mean,
you looked down onto a screen, which from memory was about 9 or 10 inch diameter circle. The superimposed onto the screen was a compass rose, which each line of the compass rose was lit. You could read off your degrees. There was concentric circles, which were ranging circles, and you turned and switched from one set of ranges to another, obviously depending on which range you're on, you read off the circles accordingly. When you got an echo, it came up as a little rectangular blob of light, not like the old sets that were a green V shape. The V, I should explain, was an inverted V with a point at the top, and this was off a little green trace that went across the screen from one side to another. It was a completely different principle. The set I was working on was early what was called PPIs, planned position indicators, which I think, from what I've seen, is the method that's been used more or less since then.
Now, when you got this rectangular shape, what did you do then?
Well, you reported its range and bearing to the bridge. I mean, the reporting procedure was radar bridge, and the voice would come back, whoever was near the voice, probably on the officer of watch, would come back, bridge radar.
Was this on a phone?
No, on a voice pipe. A metal voice pipe, I think they were brass or copper. It echoed quite well, actually. You were quite clear. And you'd report what you saw, the range of bearing. There might be a discussion as what one thought it might be or might not be. And they just tended to carry on reporting any change. We very often start the plot going automatically.
Now, how did you operate the plotting table?
Well, the plotting table was a glass top table with a compass rose that was lined up to the ship's head under the glass. It moved across according to the direction and speed the ship was going, and on top of the glass was a tracing paper, and you threw off the range and bearing from the compass rose onto the tracing paper. It was then a permanent record of what had transpired. You were able, with a little table which you had alongside, to work out course and speed, which obviously was useful in a variety of ways. The job became monotonous, the same as all these sort of things do. Obviously, there was the odd excitement when you really had something worthwhile, or you thought you had something worthwhile. But a lot of the time was spent, especially when you were escorting a convoy. You'd have a position on the fringe of the convoy, which you were protecting, and you'd be given a bearing and a range that the ship, that we as a ship, were required to keep station on a particular ship on the convoy. It may have been, shall we say, Red 90, 4,000 yards, which was obviously to the port side of the convoy. 4,000 yards away on a particular ship. You couldn't see what the ship looked like, and it was a blob of light amongst a load of other blob of lights in a convoy. You could see them in rows or in columns. And if the range and bearing altered, you reported to the bridge, and it was then up to the officer of the watch to get the ship, our ship, back on station. As I said before, this can become very, very monotonous and boring, but that was the job that had to be done. 95% of it was routine. 5% of it was coming with it.
Now, there were a couple other incidents during this period. One was there was a glider bomb attack.
Yeah, that was after.
What do you remember of that?
Can I tell you...
Okay, yeah.
There's one in other instance that I cannot tell you the dates and the time, but it was in the same period in the bay when we were protecting a convoy on one side, and the other side of the screen was the famous EG2 Captain Walker's group. We had a very busy night. And if my memory serves me correctly, no ships were lost. The next day, we were rather pleased to receive a signal from the famous Captain Walker, and I think the signal was, well done the 4th. He was referring to the 4th Escort Group. Coming from the man like that, I suppose we were justified in being proud. Another instance that took place down there, and I almost certainly it was a Sunday morning. There was, the Germans had produced a new type of bomb called a radio control bomb that honed in on your electrical or stuff. I don't know how it worked, but suffice to say, it was a new type of development. The 6 ships were doing a sweep, that's the 4th Escort Group, and obviously we reported on the radar. I cannot remember when I was on the 2nd, not on the 6th, but an aircraft was approaching, and obviously she came closer and closer and dropped down in height, and it was enormous. Heikel, I think it was a 117, a very black, horrible looking thing, 4 engines. I suppose the nearest thing you could say, looking at today, it was like a Boeing 707. When I say a 707, I'm trying to give you an idea of size. Now this thing came up astern of us. I'm not very good at measurements and judgments, but I would think it was dropping down to about 500 feet. She was quite steady. We were firing at her. Everything that was able to bring to bear on it. We could see that we saw the bomb bay doors open quite clearly. Because I must tell you that I had nipped out of the flag deck to see what was going on. And we saw the bomb quite clearly leave the belly of the plane and land 50-100 yards astern, a rather large splash. Fortunately, the radio control mechanism did not work, otherwise I'm not here to tell you the story. I could quite categorically say I could put my hand on my heart and say I wanted my money that moment. I'm not a hero, I'm a normal person. She then, the plane, veered away and attacked another one of our sister ships, the Drury. I believe she also dropped a bomb, also missed, but I think shrapnel came inboard onto the Drury, although I'm glad to say nobody was hurt. Many years later, subsequently, I heard a report that that day there were 17 of these planes out on patrol from obviously French airroads. German plane baseball, and it would appear that 3 of these planes did not return. Maybe our guns had an effect on the one that attacked us. I cannot tell you.
Now, another thing around this time was that there was a clash with 2 U-boats found on the surface and then chased with 6 depth charges. You don't remember that at all. You only remember the one you told us about, all right. How about fatigue? I mean, you had a watch, but you know, with the action stations and there's a reference to 36 hours of continuous action. How about, did fatigue affect you a great deal? You had this?
No, I would not be able to remember. I cannot be. It's a feeling that you can't remember a feeling. I remember fear, but I can't remember fatigue. The probability is we were a bit tired, and if I do, what I can remember. Obviously, we had some sort of food, and it was usually large wads of bread with corned beef in. What we had to drink, I don't remember. It may have been tea. I can't remember.
Anything else about that convoy? You were zipping about between convoy to convoy, between...
That's a headless chicken from Scotland Cats. We've been nipping about like lunatics.
Anything else you remember in particular of that period? No, not particularly. Now, you were based... Were you based at Pollock Dock then?
Yeah, Belfast, Pollock Dock. We always, or invariably, went back there. I mean, that was our home base. That was where any refits were done, any repairs were done, the stores were taken on. It was our home port.
And what do you remember of Pollock Dock and Belfast as a home?
Yes, I'll tell you a story. As it's all those years ago, and I can no longer be put in a rattle for it, I will tell you the story. There was three other chaps and myself who were extremely close friends. We all did our rum ration every day. We were old enough to. And we organised it whereby always one of the three had the afternoon watch. Now, when you had your tot, it made you very, very sleepy. And obviously, it was a very serious matter to fall asleep on watch. Therefore, it was arranged that whoever had the afternoon watch did not have their tot. The tot was poured into a bottle and duly corked. It so happens that my locker was the one used to keep the bottles in. They must have been mad, the other three, to trust me, but still they did. Naval raincoats were long, loose-fitting raincoats with side pockets, and you could put an awful lot in these pockets without being seen, because they were very loose-fitting. Pollock Dock ran straight onto a little narrow street. There was two enormous great gates that were always open, wood, I think they were blue, black, green, dark colour, across a narrow street, and right opposite the gates to the pub. I cannot tell you the name of the pub, but the landlady was an elderly woman. Her name was Mother something, I can't remember, they called her Mother something or other. And as we used to go ashore, we used to have one or two, sometimes more, bottles in our raincoat pockets. And we went straight into the pub, into the back room, unloaded our bottles, and we got, in those days, £5 a bottle. Now, when I was explained to you that I was getting about £1 in today's money, £1.50 to £2 a fortnight, a bottle of rum at £5 was a fortune.
And this was what you were smuggling ashore from, that you'd saved up?
Yes, that's why I said, after 50 years of visiting on the castles and coming to rescue now, if they do, well, they've got to prove it. My word against that theirs.